I should be frightened by these words, having been yanked from bed and shuffled to the train station in the middle of the night. But I, like my father, am simply angry that I am here in the first place.
Don't be ridiculous, father says. He's telling the truth.
A man steps forward to join Kerensky, and I can feel Alexei shrink away at the sight of him. Unnaturally tall, daunting. His skin is smooth and ageless, but his hair and beard are black and bushy, like one of the Chechen Highlanders. He has strange slanted eyes that look as though they belong to an animal. A lit cigar rests in the corner of his mouth, and a red handkerchief hangs limp and macabre from the pocket of his military uniform. He puffs on his cigar and blows the smoke in father's face.
I saw the crowds beside the tracks, waiting, as we travel from Petrograd.
This is Evgeny Koblinsky, Kerensky says, motioning to the bizarre newcomer. He will accompany you on this trip. His word is law in my absence.
We are to be passed off again?
You should thank me, Nicholas. There are worse people I could pass you off to.
Poor Alexei, drained and overwhelmed. I can feel the sob building in his chest. So I hush him, rub his back, and say in a low voice, Don't be afraid. Look at him. Who does he remind you of? He braves a peek from beneath my arm.
A monster.
I laugh. He's gotten the answer right, whether he knows it or not. Yes, but which monster? Think.
I don't know.
Alexei stares at our new escort. His long, gangly arms wave in disagreement as he argues with father. Do you remember the legends about a peculiar man who travels the forest provoking pilgrims? Realization clicks, and Alexei looks up at me.
The Leshy.
I grin. And what does the Leshy look like? Alexei creases his forehead, trying to remember the old folk tales our governess read to us.
He's always smoking or stealing tobacco.
His eyes drift to that cigar and the trailing line of smoke.
His hair is wild, and his eyes strange. What's the last thing? How do you know you found a Leshy in the woods, and not just an old man? What does he always wear?
He smiles weakly.
Something red. Like that kerchief in his pocket.
Smart boy. So let's not worry, okay? He's just a Leshy. Harmless, really. Some people even believe they're guardians sent to protect the unlucky traveller.
Do you remember how to drive one away when you're tired of it? By praying.
Or? Alexei giggles and pulls away from me.
Cursing.
We can practice cursing on the train, yes? I'll tell you all of the words that Cook has taught me. There are dark circles beneath my brother's eyes, and he looks as though he could be blown over by the slightest wind. But the fear is gone, so I consider the lesson a success.
We'll call him Leshy, just the two of us. It will be our joke, yes?
Alexei nods, then gathers joy in his arms. Mollified, he wanders off to join father beside the tracks.
You are a very clever girl, Anastasia.
Botkin's voice, low near my ear.
And a damn good sister.
I shrug off the compliment.
I don't like to see him afraid.
He's lucky to have you. They all are.
You might be the only one who believes that.
They know it, whether they admit it or not.
Botkin tugs the end of my braid affectionately.
But let's keep the cursing to a minimum, yes? At least if your parents are within earshot.
The whistle blows loud and urgent. Kerensky looks to the platform in the distance and the growing crowd. He motions us toward the train, urging us to board. It is my brother who notices the obvious. Alexei scans the compartments and the legion of curious faces peering back at us.
Father,
he asks,
where are we going?
They say we are headed to England.
Then why are there so many soldiers on this train?
Part 2. Friends and Enemies. And after all, what is a lie? 'Tis but the truth in masquerade. Lord Byron. Don Juan. Chapter 9. Anna. Hanover, 1946-1943. Winterstein, Germany. November 1946. Anna has every intention of cutting the soldier's throat. He has only to take one step closer and she will lunge. The serrated knife in her hand is meant to be used for slicing bread, but she thinks it will handle the soft skin of a man's neck easily enough. He is a Bolshevik, an officer in the Red Army, and he has come, like so many others in recent months, to raid the castle. The war has made the soldiers bold, and they pass through daily on their way to Berlin, taking what they want and leaving chaos behind them. Occasionally it's food or clothing they seek, but usually their hungers are of a more carnal nature. By the way he stares at the swell of her breasts, Anna doubts this soldier has crept into the kitchen for breakfast. Anna never once thought she would still be facing the threat of rape at this age, nor did she imagine that she would still be running and hiding. There are other, safer places where she could have sought refuge, but Anna had so little time when leaving Hanover, what with the bombs falling and the city burning and the earth shaking beneath her feet. She took only what she could carry and showed up here, on the doorstep of a sympathetic acquaintance. A practical choice, though risky and ultimately flawed. She was able to make the journey from Hanover to Winterstein on foot in less than a day, but here she is, staring danger in the face once again. "Frau," the soldier says, motioning her with his fingers. His voice is sticky with lust. "Come here." There is not the slightest tremble in Anna's voice when she responds. She speaks clearly and confidently, but in German. Russian is too great a risk with the Red Army forcibly repatriating nationals to the newly formed Soviet Union. Anna has heard the rumors of how Romanov friends and sympathizers were systematically hunted down and assassinated after the revolution. She does not care to think what they would do with a woman who claims to be Grand Duchess Anastasia. "If I come to you, it will be to disembowel you on the threshold," she says, raising the knife and holding it up so he can see the wicked points of the blade. "Or you can come to me, and I will do it here, on the kitchen floor." She is stunned to see that her hand does not shake, not even the slightest tremble. This man wants her to fear him. He wants her to run and scream and cry, to beg for mercy. When she does none of this, his posture changes. He looks from her face to the blade, back and forth, measuring her resolve, her distance, his chances. The soldier straightens from his subtle, predatory crouch, his face awash with uncertainty. He does not look like a man who wants to bleed out on a cold November morning. Anna can see him decide that she is not worth the trouble. It's there, on his forehead, as the lines of concentration smooth away, in his hands, as they go from clenched to relaxed. His shoulders drop. He takes one step backward, then another. And in 5 seconds he is gone, retreating out the kitchen door and onto the lawn, a dark, hunched form against the silver blanket of frost. Her hands shake now, and the knife clatters to the floor. Anna raises her trembling fingers to the door and slides the bolt into place, then watches the soldier disappear into the tree line. Damn those nightmares that haunt her dreams since Hanover. They are loud with the whistle of falling bombs, and they shatter inside her head, keeping sleep at bay almost every night. She curses herself for rising early and making her way downstairs in search of coffee, for crossing the kitchen yard to collect a jug of cream at the spring house, for leaving the door unlocked behind her. She didn't consider that the light would draw anything other than moths. She blows out the lantern on the counter. It was foolish, really, to fight the dreams and leave her bed at all. To come here in the first place. Anna is certain, now more than ever, that she cannot stay in Winterstein. Not with the lingering Soviet occupation and the constant threat of discovery and repatriation. It is time to go. Anna slips from the kitchen in search of the one working phone in this castle. It is time to send word to Prince Frederick. He's been in Altenburg for several years, waiting out the war like everyone else. He has done so much to help, and she hates to disturb him again, but Anna must find a place where she can disappear forever. 3 years earlier. Hanover, Germany. October 8th, 1943. Anna is in bed when the bombs begin to fall. Her apartment is on the third floor of an old building near the Marstall Gate, along the bank of the River Leine. The one-bedroom flat has high ceilings, wood floors, and exposed brick walls, ample windows, sparse, gently used furniture. There is wallpaper in the bathroom and rusty plumbing throughout. The place smells of lemon oil, mothballs, dust, and cedar. Somehow this combination means home to her, now that she has been here for almost 5 years. This is the first time since the boarding house in Berlin that she has lived entirely by herself, and even though it was a strange adjustment at first, she has grown to love the independence and the solitude. Anna loves the quiet. No, not quiet. Not now. It is nearly 1 in the morning, and the air is filled with thunder and chaos, ear-splitting bedlam. As Anna stumbles out of bed, the room is lit with a blinding white light, like a spotlight, like a vision, the way she imagines it will be when she passes into eternity. And that is her first thought, that she has died, and it is only the raging sound of explosions that convinces her she is still alive, for now. Anna blinks furiously and finally sees something out the window. It hangs from a streetlight at the corner, right outside her building, glowing a phosphorescent white. A Christmas tree. But not the kind of tree cut and decorated during the holidays. This is the sort dropped from the warplanes flown by the Allied forces. A nickname given to the parachute flares that mark a designated target on the ground. And there, several blocks farther down the street, is another. They always come in fours, tidily boxing in their targets. Anna does not wait to see where the others will land. Muscle memory is an odd thing, linked to music and athletics and survival. Anna does not even have to tell her limbs to move, to run. They do it on their own. She's across the room, yanking open the top drawer of her dresser before she has time to register a single coherent thought. Anna's thin cotton nightgown falls to her ankles. She wears nothing beneath it, but she does not have time to dress, so she yanks a pile of clothing from her closet and throws it into a suitcase. Then she dumps the contents of the dresser drawer into it as well. A photo album, an icon, a chess set, a paper knife, keepsakes from a former life that she will not leave behind, cards she might yet need to play. Boots. She pulls them over her feet, but does not lace them. No socks. No stockings. Her toes are cold. A long, heavy coat hangs on a hook by the door. She yanks it over her shoulders and down her arms. It is not belted or buttoned. There is no time. She tears through the apartment and out her front door. Anna crosses the landing and plunges down 3 flights of stairs, holding her suitcase in one hand and the stair rail in the other. She flies down, her feet barely touching the worn wooden steps. Heart banging in her chest, breath catching in her throat every time the roof rattles and the walls shake. Another blinding flash of cruel white light. The third Christmas tree. Run for the cellar. It is the single thought she is able to form as she goes down, down, down those steps. And then the lobby with its chipped tile and heavy door. A hard left, and she darts down the hallway. Other people are there, but she does not stop and greet them. She runs. They all run. A child cries. A woman cries. A man curses. Another door. Another set of stairs descending into darkness, and Anna is only 2/3 of the way down before she is knocked off her feet and sent tumbling down the remaining 5 steps to land on her knees on the hard concrete floor. The impact sends a jolt of pain through her entire body. She can feel it in her teeth, at the back of her skull. Someone trips over her, curses. She crawls toward the wall and curls into a ball, suitcase between her knees, hands over her ears, eyes squeezed shut. The air around her vibrates, filled with the screaming of people and the screaming of bombs. And then one eerie moment of total silence as that sickening white light from the fourth flare spills into the cellar. The single light bulb hanging from the ceiling explodes, illuminating for one morbid second the terrified faces around her. And then the air is ripped apart. In the morning, there is nothing left but scattered bricks and splintered timber. No building. No apartment. The residents who made it into the cellar step out into the grim reality of Armageddon. The Allied forces had not been targeting their building after all, but something farther down the street. She knows this only because of the 10-foot crater in the ground a block away. The shock of the explosion flattened her building, but those structures that were beside the crater were decimated, turned to ash. In the other direction, the buildings are still standing, but their windows and doors are gone, like missing teeth in blackened skulls. Anna cannot bear to look at the people who wander, stricken through the rubble. The air is filled with soot and ash, with the wailing of women and the blare of distant sirens. What remains of Hanover is on fire. Smoke billows upward in every direction, and it takes Anna several minutes to find the sun, to orient herself. Two blocks, picking her way through the rubble, bricks and posts and bits of furniture, bits of people, and she sees the Marstall gate. It stands unscathed, its white stone arch is eerily pristine, without so much as a crack or a smudge of soot. Anna passes through and finds the footpaths along the river to be mercifully clear of debris. She stops long enough to wash her face and hands, to tie her boots and belt her coat. Then she walks south toward Winterstein.
Chapter 10. Anastasia. Exile. 1917. Cherepovets, Russia. August 1st.
From Gleb, Dr. Botkin says, setting a small round bundle in my hand. I fold back the edges of his crisp white monogrammed handkerchief to find a pair.
It should be ripe in a day or two.
How?
He made me promise I'd deliver it to you, and he was very specific. This pair, not any of the others, and only once we'd left.
Botkin sits down beside me and rests his heavy, warm hand on my shoulder.
He said they're your favorite.
They are. Emotion, heavy and scratching, lodges at the back of my throat. I have to clear it before I can speak. Thank you. It is the Krasulia pair Gleb saw me admiring that day in the garden. I didn't let him climb the tree and fetch it for me, but he found a way to make sure I got it anyway. Stupid, stubborn, sweet boy. A ridiculous gesture. Totally unnecessary. I blink hard, pushing back tears.
Keep the handkerchief, Botkin says,
then leaves the compartment and slides the door shut behind him. I press Botkin's handkerchief to my face and stifle a sob. My mother is a weeper, my sisters as well, but I want to be a different sort of woman. A woman like my great-grandmother, Queen Victoria of England. A woman so calm and collected and sure of herself that she is called a brass-plated bitch behind closed doors. I doubt very much that such a simple gift, an unexpected act of kindness, would make her go to pieces. Yet here I am, wiping snot on Dr. Botkin's linen kerchief. Jimmy presses his cold, wet nose into my hand, and I glance up to see those great pale eyes looking at me curiously, his ears turned forward and pitched like a tent. I refuse to believe that animals are incapable of emotion, that they cannot communicate. Jimmy has always possessed a preternatural ability to sense what I am feeling and to comfort me when necessary. I'm okay, I whisper, and scratch him on the hard knob between his ears. Satisfied that all is well, he flops at my feet again, huffs in contentment, and begins to snore. By the time Alexei enters the compartment several minutes later and sits across from me, I am dry-eyed and composed once again, at least on the outside. Inside, however, I feel strangely untethered. Once, when I was very little, I climbed the willow tree in our sitting garden and settled into the crook of a branch to eat a stolen sweet, a jam tart I'd pinched from the kitchen, but I didn't notice the oozing sap that dripped down the trunk. I leaned against it, and by the time I had licked the crumbs from my fingers, a heavy strand of hair was stuck to the bark. Too proud to call for help, I yanked myself free and lost a patch of hair in the process. That's how I feel as the train travels eastward, my thumb brushing the thick, firm skin of the pear. Ripped away. We travel east all day, only stopping at sidings in small towns and sparse villages, but we are never allowed off the train. With every mile, Father grows more and more grim. Every hour we travel east, into the sun rather than away from it, means our chances of going to England diminish. Father paces up and down the narrow hallway of our car, peering out the small square windows on either end. 350 soldiers travel with us, farm boys and villagers mostly, men conscripted into service at the beginning of the war. Neither political nor dangerous, simply following orders and biding their time until they can go home. They are crammed into the other train cars, practically spilling out the windows. Our car remains mercifully private, except for Leshy, Semyon, and the boy called Thomas, all of whom watch us carefully any time the train slows. When Father isn't pacing the hallway, he sits with Mother in their compartment, methodically tracking each train station we pass, trying to decipher our destination as though it's some puzzle he must solve. I hear them once, discussing our route.
Tsiekvin, Sheropovets, Shavra.
Father taps the map with his pencil.
We're still going east.
I don't even remember these places, Mother says.
That's because we've never been to them.
Is that the point, then? Drag us around the whole of Russia and humiliate us?
No, Alex,
he whispers.
I think they have something else in mind.
I do not stay to hear what he thinks that something else might be, but seek out Botkin for a game of dominoes instead. Only a small retinue of servants has been allowed to travel with us. Dr. Botkin, Dova, Cook, and Alexei Troop, Father's valet, who we simply call Troop, because Mother insists there are already too many Alexeys in our household. Everyone else has been sent away, back to their homes, to relative safety. These four refuse to abandon us, and my affection for them increases daily as a result. Our tutor, Pierre Gilliard, will join us once we reach our final destination. I spend the afternoon distracting myself with endless games of dominoes and whist. Botkin, ever the gentleman, lets me win four times. Dinner comes and goes, served to us in our compartment by an Armenian chef hired by the railway line. Cook has been forbidden to leave our train car or help in the galley, so he takes his meal with a sour face and a poor attitude, complaining all the while that the meat is dry. But the simple meal of roasted chicken and vegetables tastes fine to me. It comes with hot bread and is wonderfully seasoned. I don't even realize how hungry I am until I find my plate empty. I want more, but am unsure whether that's allowed. So I let my dish be cleared away without speaking a word. The sun is setting when Leshy finally orders the train to stop so we can stretch our legs. He unwinds his long, rangy body from where he sits beside the door and leads us outside. There is no station, no railway siding to be seen, only rolling green fields dotted with trees and bushes stretching out in either direction. Joy, Jimmy, and Ortimo, so eager to relieve themselves, are out, darting between our legs, before any of us can get down the stairs. My parents drift off to speak in low whispers, while Alexei and my sisters pick bilberries in a low, scrubby hedge.
You have 15 minutes, Semyon announces.
Ultimo scuttles away at the harsh sound of his voice, and I see Thomas's brows draw tight beneath the brim of his cap. He says nothing, but simply wanders off a short distance and watches us patiently. Semyon, however, slides the bolt on his rifle and rests it against his shoulder, ready, I presume, in the event that any of us decides to run.
"Stay near the train," he shouts.
I press my heels against the tracks and take Gleb's pair from my pocket. The setting sun washes the clouds with a gentle pink that matches the skin of the Krazulia, and I take it for a sign as I bite deeply into the flesh. For once, Botkin is wrong. The pear is perfectly, deliciously ripe, and I eat the whole thing, seeds, stem, and core, as the sun disappears below the horizon. When the whistle blows, we all file back toward the train. Semyon stands by the door to our car, waiting, I think, to kick Ultimo as he passes. But Tatiana scoops the little dog into her arms and steps up into the train with her nose in the air. Jimmy stays by my side, attentive and protective, as I fall back to walk beside Father. I lean my head against his arm. "Where do you think they're taking us?" He pulls me closer and kisses the top of my head. His voice tightens when he says,
"To Siberia."
5 days later. Tumen, Russia, August 6th. The penal colonies were established in the early 1800s as a means of punishing criminals, dissidents, and anyone else who ruffled the sensitive feathers of my forefathers. I know this. Of course I know this. Pierre Gilliard has covered this, along with all of the other grand sweeping moments of Russian history. But to the best of my knowledge, which I can now admit is grossly insufficient, we are the first royals in history to be condemned to this legendary exile. We continue rolling east through Katyn, Tchaikovsky, Perm, Kameshava, Pokalovska, and Ekaterinburg. I am stiff and sore and tired. Every mile in that rattling old train multiplies into an eternity. I cannot get comfortable. I cannot focus on my thoughts or the book laid open in my lap. The thunder of the tracks pounds in my ears constantly, setting my nerves on edge. The dogs whine. None of us have bathed, and we've barely slept since leaving Saskoye Selo. So it's understandable that when the train finally pulls to a stop in Tumen near midnight, we stupidly think our journey is at an end. That is until Leshy orders that our belongings be loaded onto a steamer whose engine is chugging like a tubercular old man beside the dock. Father, exhausted and belligerent, marches toward him with fists balled.
"What is the meaning of this? Why must we leave the train?"
Leshy plucks the cigar from his mouth and blows a cloud of smoke in Father's face.
"The tracks stop here."
As Father coughs, he adds,
"Count yourself lucky. Boats can make the passage only a few months each summer. If this were winter, you'd be traveling by horse and cart."
It takes hours to load our belongings onto the ship, with those weary, bitter soldiers trudging back and forth, single file, from the train to the ship, carrying boxes and trunks and furniture. It is not until dawn that the great lumbering steamer, Rus, pulls away from the dock and into the muddy current. Brown water, brown riverbanks, brown fields, brown huts, the occasional brown-clad peasant. That's all we see until the next day, when we merge first into the Tobol River and then later into the Irtysh and the marshes of eastern Siberia. We have no rooms on board the Rus, only hard berths and scratchy blankets in the great cavernous hold. There is no privacy, no separation from the soldiers, and very little in the way of facilities. The hold smells of bad plumbing and unwashed mails, so I stay on deck with Father until forced to bed that second night. We keep to our designated corner, in bunks stacked three high, while Botkin, Trup, and Cook take turns keeping watch. They do not like the way Semyon leers at us in the darkness, the way he stares shamelessly. Twice I wake to Jimmy's low warning growl as Semyon passes near Olga's bunk. I can feel the rumble against my legs, and I see the points of Jimmy's sharp, white teeth flashing in the dark. I sleep finally, but in fits and starts, while Jimmy lies curled beside me, head resting on his paws, his pale blue eyes gleaming in the dark. I am up before dawn to join Father on the deck. As always, Jimmy follows close behind. The breeze is minimal, but the air is clean, and Father smokes his pipe at the rail, telling me stories of his childhood and his travels. I pay no attention to the details, but rather listen to the cadence of his voice, taking comfort when he sets his hand atop my head, when he drapes an arm around my shoulders, in the sweet, rich smell of his pipe. When breakfast comes, I have no appetite whatsoever, so I feed the cold eggs and boiled potatoes to Jimmy. Father takes his portion without complaint and eats it quickly. I marvel at his ability to chew and swallow without tasting or grimacing. He is notoriously picky with cook at home, yet suddenly his palate seems to have lost all discernment.
"That is the home of Grigory Rasputin,"
Father says an hour later, pointing toward a white stone house high on the bank after we pass through Pokrovskaya. He doesn't exactly spit the words, but there is no fondness in his tone. Should I get Mother?
No, it will only trouble her.
We stand in silence, watching the house fade into the distance. Rasputin came from the borderlands of Russia, only to rise in Mother's favor and then in power. He embedded himself in our lives. His daughter Maria was even my friend for a time. We played together as young children. And then it was all over. Rasputin's end was grisly, and here we are, passing his beginnings. Fate does twist her knife in the most unexpected ways. Mercifully, our journey comes to a close late that afternoon. We are greeted in Tobolsk, at the far reaches of Siberia, by two memorable things as the Rus chugs into position against the dock. Church bells pealing loud across the city, and mosquitoes the size of bumblebees. A ringing in one ear and a buzzing in the other.
"We have been delivered to hell," Father says, swatting at his neck, then wiping a bloody smudge on his pant leg. "And they are celebrating."
Chapter 11. Anna. The Khanzhovska Affair. 1938. 1932, 1931. Hanover, Germany. July 9th, 1938. "I see you've gotten married," Anna says, looking at the gold band on the ring finger of Gleb Botkin's left hand. Such an American thing to do. Russians wear their wedding rings on the right. Sellout. This fact disappoints her almost as much as the marriage itself. "I was going to tell you." Gleb sticks his hand in his pocket defensively. "She's a nice girl. Lovely." "I didn't say otherwise." "Listen, I haven't seen you in years. 7 years. You don't owe me an explanation?" "She's American." "I assumed as much." "That means I can stay in America. You know how important that is to your cause." He says it like this is some compromise on his part, as if he has sacrificed something on her behalf. Anna is exhausted, and Gleb's stammering makes her even more so. It's not like they had any sort of understanding. She hasn't seen him since New York, since that last fiasco he got her into. Hell, he didn't even know they locked her away in that asylum for a year, until after she'd been shipped back to Germany. Anna has no claim on him. Yet this still hurts. It's an embarrassing realization to come to her in her 40s. Gleb looks so eager to explain, to apologize, that Anna almost asks the name of the strange new wife he has acquired. Almost. But Edward Fallows steps through the door before she has time to give in to sympathy. Her lawyer has aged considerably in the years since she last saw him. They communicate regularly by letter and telephone, but have not been in the same room since New York. His hair has gone grey at the temples. His back has grown rounded. And he wears spectacles, thick and very English-looking. Edward Fallows was not a man blessed with good lips to begin with, and they are tight and thin now, like dried orange peels.
"Are you ready?" he asks.
"No, but I don't have a choice, do I?" She's only answering the summons because Gleb is present. And I didn't really think he'd make the trip all the way from America. But now that he has come, she can't very well avoid it any longer. The interrogation has been ordered by Adolf Hitler. His interest in Anna's case has only grown in the months since he accosted her in Berlin. "Let's go, then," Gleb says, offering her a hand. If it hadn't been his left hand, she might have accepted it. But she stares at that gold band for a moment and rises from the couch on her own. The Hanover Police Headquarters is located 7 kilometers from Anna's new apartment. They drive in silence. There is no point in discussing strategy. One does not refuse the Führer, not if one enjoys breathing. Anna has brushed up against death often enough to know that she is not ready to permanently inhabit its cold, clammy grasp. Police headquarters are housed inside an ornate building that was once a library. Libraries these days are frowned upon, but the structure retains its charm, and she hopes that the ghosts of those stories still haunt the corridors. She hopes they torment the Nazis at night. They are met at the top of 5 wide steps by an SS officer proudly wearing his red arm patch and a scowl. "This way," he says, snapping his heels together and leading them through the double doors and deep into the building. Hallways, corners, stairs. Anna doesn't keep track of their route. She has little reason to believe she will be led out the same way. It is her assumption that this soldier, or one just like him, will take her out the back in handcuffs. Anna is wearing her best wool suit for the occasion. Pale grey, soft as a lamb's ear. A matching cloche, silk stockings, new black leather pumps, satin gloves, and a string of pearls. If she is going to be hauled off to prison, she might as well look sharp. Whatever the outcome of this meeting, it's time to put the Schanzkowska affair to rest. The officer leads Anna, Gleb, and Fallows into a large interrogation room. Inside are 4 people, seated on one side of a long wooden table. There is an enormous rectangular mirror on the wall behind them. Double-sided, no doubt. She guesses that whoever is on the other side will remain anonymous. If the Führer has made the trip from Berlin to witness this meeting firsthand, he hasn't condescended to show himself. In any case, Anna finds the visible occupants of the room troubling enough. All 4 Schanzkowska siblings, Valerian, Felix, Gertrude, and Maria Juliana. Stair-stepped in age, they are very attractive in an earthy, rural sort of way. They are clearly impoverished. Both women wear simple, homemade dresses of drab black, and neither man has a tie or pair of suspenders between them, but they have the strong, sinewy look of people who work hard for a living. Clear-eyed and brown from the sun, they have scrubbed up the best they can, but Anna can still see the residue of manual labour beneath their fingernails. Ordered to attend this meeting, and pulled from their fields and their factories, they are anxious and wary. Not that she could blame them. Anna takes a seat with Gleb and Fallows on either side of her. The officer sits at one end of the table, while Anna stares at the older woman, Gertrude, knowing immediately what every person around this table sees. A startling resemblance between them. Anna has known Gleb Botkin long enough to perceive when he is nervous, and the telltale tapping of his shoes gives him away now. Gertrude Schanzkowska has Anna's same high cheekbones, dark hair, and startling blue eyes. Their noses and mouths are similar, as is their height and build. The lines around Gertrude's eyes are deeper, and there is more silver in her hair, but even a casual observer can see they could be sisters. The officer scribbles in his file. "Can we please get this over with?" Anna asks in German. The siblings confer in Polish, looking at her and then away. They take in her fine clothing and her meticulous grooming. The careful distance she keeps across the table. They size her up against the memory of the woman she is accused of being. Their long-lost sister. A mentally unstable woman who disappeared in early 1920. A charge brought against Anna a decade earlier by relatives of the imperial family. The dates line up, as do appearances, and it's easy to understand why she hasn't been able to shake this accusation since that ambush in Wasserburg. She knows Gleb is thinking of it now, as he gazes unblinking on these four Polish witnesses. If only he hadn't taken her to the inn that day. If only they hadn't fallen into the trap so neatly laid by that private investigator. Anna shakes her head, clears her thoughts, focuses on the present. The officer slides a paper across the table and places it before Valerian's Hanschowska. This is an affidavit stating that this woman is your sister, Franziska. If you identify her as such today, you will all be required to sign it before leaving. What the officer does not mention is that if they sign the affidavit, Anna will be charged with fraud, and at the very least, imprisoned. Whether the Schanschowska siblings know this is unclear. Valerian looks at Anna. His eyes are brown, soft and round, like an American penny. He takes in her pearls, the necklace, the earrings, the ring on her right forefinger, and shakes his head slowly. This lady looks too different, too elegant. My sister was a simple woman. See, I'm not the woman you're looking for, Anna says to the officer. But then Valerian speaks to her directly. Do you have children? He asks. Of course she doesn't have children. What kind of a question is that? Gleb demands. Let the woman answer for herself, the officer says. Anna can feel a vein throbbing in her throat, right where her neck and chin meet in a gentle curve. There is only the briefest hesitation before she answers, no. And then after she has had a second to think, she asks, why? Because the last time I saw Franziska, she was pregnant.
Oh, please do record that in your files, Edward Fallows tells the officer.
He doesn't even glance up, unperturbed at this bit of new information. And how many years since you last saw your sister? The officer asks.
19. That's a long time. Long enough for anyone to age, to change fortunes. He glances at Anna. To change appearances.
Valerian stares at her steadily. She meets the gaze, eyes narrowed, back stiff, mouth drawn in tight. She is defiant, desperate. Don't do this. Please. If she could scream the words at him, she would.
No one changes that much. This woman is not my sister, he says finally, and slides the affidavit to his brother, seated beside him.
Felix looks at the paper. He has blue eyes, like Gertrude, like her. He reads the affidavit slowly, quietly. The officer notes Valerian's statement dispassionately in his messy scrawl.
And what of the rest of you? Do you concur?
Anna has seen Felix Hanschowska twice in the last 2 decades. Once in Wasserburg, and once years earlier in a meeting that, as far as she knows, remains undocumented to this day. It cannot be brought up now or used against her, but that doesn't ease the tremor of fear that beats against her ribcage. Of all the siblings, his face is the most inscrutable. No hint of his thoughts or what his reaction will be.
This woman does not look a thing like Franziska, Felix says after staring at Anna for some time. She doesn't even look like the same woman I saw at Wasserburg 11 years ago. Can we go home now?
Maria Juliana agrees. She is the youngest of them, and it is clear she worships her brothers. She will not contradict them. She doesn't want to be here. The woman practically withers beneath the scrutiny. She doesn't even bother to read the affidavit before pushing it farther down the table to her sister, Gertrude. Each of Maria Juliana's fingernails is bitten down to the quick, but that doesn't stop her from picking at them with her teeth. "I've never seen this woman before in my life," she says. The officer seems uncomfortable. 3 denials. Not the outcome he expected. Anna is poised in her chair, ready to leave this dank room behind, when Gertrude leaps to her feet. "What is wrong with you?" she screams, actually screams at her siblings. "This woman is our sister!" Gleb and Fallows push back against their chairs, startled. Gertrude turns to Anna. "I know you are Franziska. You must recognize me. Please, look at us. How can anyone deny it?" The officer turns his attention to her, triumphant, as though he has caught Anna in the middle of a great fraud. "Well," he asks, "what have you got to say?" 1 heartbeat. 4. 9. Anna counts them slowly, letting her pulse settle, forcing any potential tremor from her voice. "What am I supposed to say?" Another long beat to drive home her point. "She is lying." Gertrude begins to sob. The officer regards Anna with a vulture's stare. "How many brothers and sisters do you have?" 4, Anna answers honestly. "And here we are," Gertrude insists, wiping her nose with the back of her hand. 4. "Their names are Olga, Tatiana, Maria, and Alexei," Anna says. "My siblings are all dead." Gertrude leans across the table now, desperate. "This is insane. She is insane. Tell them the truth." The officer watches Anna closely. There is no more scribbling of notes or casual observation. "Where were you born?" "Russia." Anna spits the word out and folds her arms over her chest, hiding her trembling hands. Felix's voice is quiet, almost inaudible as he reaches down the table and places his hand on Gertrude's. "Don't you see? It isn't her. Frankie was born in Poland, like us." "Admit it!" Gertrude yanks her hand away and glares at Anna. "Admit it!" "Are any of you willing to sign that?" the officer asks, nodding toward the affidavit. He looks at each of the siblings in turn. "No," Valerian, Felix, and Maria Juliana say in unison. Gertrude hesitates, lips parted, her arm lifted several inches from her side. Anna jumps at the opportunity. "Enough of this. I'm done here." She rises smoothly from the table and stares at the two-way mirror. Her reflection shows the face of a calm, confident woman, a woman sure of who she is. Then she turns to the door and passes through without another word. Gleb and Fallows come after her a moment later. Once they are deposited outside on the sidewalk, they rush Anna toward the waiting car. "Gertrude wouldn't sign it. Too afraid of her siblings, I guess," Gleb says triumphantly. "The German government will take no further action in this case." Anna is too exhausted, too relieved to celebrate. She simply wilts into the back seat, pulling the cloche from her head and wiping one hand across her sweaty brow. Perhaps wearing wool in July wasn't such a great idea after all. "That was close, far too close," she says. Edward Fallows grins at her in the rear-view mirror. "It doesn't matter now. It's over. And besides, I have other news." Anna has learned to dread these words from him. "What news?" "As you know, the Romanovs tried to declare all of the Tsar's surviving relatives so his estate could be settled and dispersed among them. But I filed a motion to contest this, stating that you are his only surviving heir. And I have just received news that the court has agreed to see our evidence. Frederick has it in Berlin. Witness testimony, photographs, everything he could find. He is elated, almost jubilant. It's only a matter of time, and we'll have you recognized legally as Anastasia Romanov." 4 months earlier. Berlin, Germany. April 1938. Adolf Hitler is not as tall as Anna imagined. The papers make him out to be a giant, some otherworldly creature that exists on a dais, towering over his subjects,
when in reality is not much taller than she is. Anna only has to lift her chin to meet his curious gaze. The outstretched hand is harder to accept. But what else is there to do? It is an effort not to wipe her hand on her skirt afterward. Anna is only in Berlin for the day, to give one of Edward Fallows's endless depositions. 20 minutes ago she stepped out of her hotel and onto the street to go in search of an early lunch, when a large black limousine pulled to the curb and two armed SS officers stepped into her path. "You must come with us, Fräulein," they said. "Your presence is required by the Führer." The sort of words one hears in their nightmares. Slumber is the only place you can resist such a command without consequences. The officers explained nothing else on the short drive to the Kaiserhof building, and now here she stands, in a room with the leader of the Nazi party, with the man turning the world on its ear. "Please," he says, "have a seat." Anna lowers herself to the edge of the wooden chair, across from his desk. She is careful not to get too comfortable. "You must forgive me," Anna says, "but I do not understand why I am here. I only came to Berlin on business, and I will be leaving first thing in the morning. I have caused no trouble." The Führer sits on the corner of his desk, a large block of wood that looks as though it has been cut from the heart of some ancient tree. He has blue eyes, brown hair, and that famous moustache, shaved to a mere inch and a half. And I cannot help but stare at the thing as it sits there on his lip, like the dislocated bristles of a toothbrush. "Do not be alarmed," he says. "I only wish to tell you that I have had my intelligence officers perform a thorough investigation into your claims." Her voice is more of a squeak than she would like.
"My claims?"
"That you are Grand Duchess Anastasia." She clears her throat, grips the handle of her purse.
"Why?"
"Because it matters." The expression on his face is one of assurance, friendliness even, yet there is nothing in his eyes. Nothing whatsoever. They are a blank sheet of glass, and Anna has the disturbing sense that his true feelings on the subject will not reach the surface. "As you know, the world is precarious at the moment, and your claims, if true, could alter the course of history."
"If true? Am I to assume that you do not believe me?"
A smile filled with teeth, but it too sits on top of his face, not reaching his eyes. The expression is so out of place, so unnatural, it's as though she's found it on the floor or hanging on the wall.
"On the contrary," he says, "we have come to the indisputable conclusion that you are, in fact, Anastasia."
This is a good thing. This should be a good thing. Yet a holy terror begins to rise in her chest, to fill her with dread.
"I am glad you believe me. So few people do."
"I don't just believe you. I support you. And it is my sincere desire that you will support me as well." So he's getting to the point, finally.
"In what way?"
The Führer leaves his perch on the edge of his desk and goes to sit behind it.
"My agents have concluded that your family was betrayed by the British government during the revolution of 1917. Disloyalty sickens me. England will pay for what they did to you."
Only the two of them sit in his office, but it does not stop that frenzied, hypnotic tone to his voice, as though he's speaking to a crowd. She hears it often enough on the radio. It is spun up with electricity now, and Anna has to force herself to sit still and listen, instead of cringing and turning away. The air almost crackles with his zeal, and she fears any movement on her part will bring a static charge. He continues,
"And when I am finished with Britain, I will move to the Soviet Union. I will annihilate the man who murdered your family."
There are no words. She has no words. So Anna gapes at him stupidly instead.
"That is where you come in," he says.
"Me?"
"Of course. You are the rightful heir to the Russian crown. Your support of my regime is imperative."
"I see."
Whatever the Führer has hidden behind the impenetrable wall of his eyes flashes through now, and Anna sees for the first time a glimpse of shrewdness when he adds, "Of course, should I find that your claims are false, should my intelligence be wrong, then imprisonment will be only the beginning of your troubles. In fact, death would be a fate too kind for such a fraud. Don't you agree?" 6 years earlier. Kuranstalt Ilten, psychiatric home, Hanover, Germany. January 1932. "Hello," the man says, sticking out his hand. "I am Ernest Frederick, Duke of Saxe-Altenburg." "Duke? Well, Prince, really. But that sounds awfully pretentious, doesn't it? Please call me Frederick." He stands there, awkwardly, until Anna realizes she has not invited him to take a seat. These royals and their manners, it's so easy to forget. "Forgive me," Anna says. "Sit. I did not expect a visit today." Her little cottage is hidden at the back of the Ilten grounds, tucked into a small copse of silver fir trees. It is bright and open, and surprisingly comfortable. Yet it is impossible to forget that it lies within the boundaries of a walled mental institution. If Prince Frederick is uncomfortable with this, he doesn't let on. "Can I get you some tea?" Anna asks. "No, thank you. I'm quite content." It is always awkward, this small talk, but Anna lets him plunge ahead. She doesn't even know where to begin. "Do you know why I'm here?" he asks, finally. He folds his hands in his lap and peers at her with a mixture of hope and wariness. "I'm afraid I don't read minds. You'll have to inform me the old-fashioned way." "My sister, Charlotte, married your cousin Sigismund, Irene's son. I am here on his behalf." "Ah, I see. My cousin sent you." Of course, he would be another Romanov detractor in disguise. Anna stifles her sigh and crosses her feet at the ankles. She sits up straighter. "How can I assist you?" "You last met my brother-in-law before the Great War, is that correct?" Anna narrows her eyes. "It's possible, though the date escapes me." "The date doesn't matter, only the details." "Details?" "Of that meeting. He has devised a list of 18 questions, you see. And the answers to these questions are known only to Anastasia Romanov. He has sent me to ask them in the hope that you can help put this matter to rest." Frederick leans forward and rests his forearms on his knees. "It's a test, I realize, and I apologize for that because I am certain you are sick to death of being tested. But if you pass, you will have Sigismund's full support. And mine." "And what of his mother, Princess Irene?" "Hers too, I believe." Anna has good reason to doubt this. The last time she sought help from the Empress Alexandra's older sister, she ended up at the bottom of the Landwehr Canal in Berlin. "You realize this is ludicrous," she says. This takes Frederick aback. "I am sorry, Tsarevna. I did not mean to insult you. I simply do not know of any other way to deliver Sigismund the proof he needs." "Not the test, you ridiculous man, the circumstances." I'm sorry, ridiculous? I'm afraid I don't catch your meaning." "We are seated on the grounds of a psychiatric hospital. No matter what I say in response to those questions, Irene will pass it off as insanity." Frederick pulls a fountain pen from his coat pocket and taps the end of it against his nose. "Oh, I see your concern, and I can assure you that I am familiar with your situation."
"My situation, meaning that I am an inmate?"
"Meaning that this," he waves his arm around to indicate the cottage, "is a rather unfortunate misunderstanding. I know that your former host, Miss Jennings, dispatched you rather abruptly. I know that the physician she employed in New York had you committed without any sort of psychiatric evaluation. And I know that you were declared perfectly sane upon your arrival back in Germany, by three different doctors, in fact." Anna wants to clarify a few points, but he continues. "I also know that given you had nowhere else to turn,
Miss Jennings paid for a 6-month stay at this facility, not in the ward itself, but in this cottage, on the grounds, since they refused to admit you as a patient. It's not exactly a holiday, but no one can accuse you of having been committed to this mental institution.
This man is becoming far more interesting by the moment.